Welcome back to MVP Real Estate Podcast, Season 3, Episode 16. We got Charles here from, if I heard before the show, you're currently in Florida. Is that right? That's correct.
Yes, I am.
Awesome. I heard two other areas. So we're going to get into your background of how your whole career developed, all the areas. And then, like you and Dan were talking, there's little nuances depending on where you are, what state you're in within real estate. So I'm sure we'll get into that in the show, but thank you so much for being here, giving us the time on a Friday.
Thank you so much, Marcus and Dan, for having me on.
Yeah, it is fun. I always start the show the same way, just a little brief 30-second background of like, who am I and how did I get to where I'm at?
Yeah, so I'm from a small town in Connecticut. I came from a real estate investing family. My dad's been a multifamily investor since 1984. He and a partner built a portfolio of probably like 100 units in the Connecticut area, a city about 15, 20 minutes from where we were grew up. And after getting out of college, I kind of followed in his steps and started, now we call it a house hack, but it was a three-family house. Lived in one of them, rented out the other floor, other floors to two other tenants. At that time, they were friends. And then it was right next to a college. And then that was at the end of 2006, at the end of 2008, I did it again. And then 2009, it was a very interesting time in the real estate market. And I purchased my first commercial property, which was a mixed use property. And so it had some residential units and a storefront. I self-managed all my units, you know, bought some other properties after that. And in 2012, moved to Florida. And since being down in Florida, for years, I had third-party management managing all my properties in Connecticut. But in 2022, we sold everything, all of our smaller stuff. And for the last 7 or 8 years, while being down in Florida, we've been focusing on larger multifamily properties throughout the Southeast.
That's awesome. So now you are completely, your whole portfolio is in Florida, or just the smaller things in Connecticut were sold?
Smaller things in Connecticut were sold. We have currently in our portfolio that we actively own is Florida, Georgia, and Texas.
That's awesome. And that's super cool. The one thing that stuck out, because you were in real estate in 2009, which was a very tough little segment, and then the years around that. And I feel like the market is kind of heading in that direction again, where we're going to have some issues. So all your past experiences of going through 2009 in that segment, are you feeling more comfortable with where we're at? Not to get too much into the economy and that, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's just, since we really focus on multifamily long-term rentals, so like when I say that 12-month leases, and I really didn't have an issue going through 08, 07. I had longer-term debt, and it was... You know, you're renting properties monthly. I mean, they cash flowed when I bought them, you know what I mean? And they cash flowed after we did our renovations to them. And, you know, if you buy them right, there's a way of, like when you're doing rentals, if you have long-term debt, you have some reserves and, you know, you have multiple units. So if one unit's out, you're still like pretty much paying your bills. That gives you a lot of buffer for going through these times. I think the problem happens is when people aren't doing their numbers correctly, there's a lot more renovations required. You know, flipping is in and out kind of business, but it's also something that there's a lot more risk, right? When you start owning the properties longer term, there's less risk. You know what I mean? If your financing matches with that strategy. So I see where we're going now, and I don't know, you know, exactly where it is, but you know, we bought our last property at the end of 2022. We just sold a property like a week ago, one of our properties in Tampa. So we're buying and selling still. But when I'm looking at buying properties, you look at something, you're like, okay, this should have been like $15,000 or $20,000 more per unit, you know, a year, year and a half before. And even if that goes down even more, you know what I mean, in the next year or so, it's still going to be a great buy. You know what I mean? It's still going to be a great buy. Like there's no, I don't think you're ever going to be able to time the market. You know what I mean? Everybody wants to time the market for the last, but you don't know what's going to happen. Real estate is such a lagging industry compared to, you know, if you pull up CNBC, you're looking at something, you're like, oh, now I'm going to sell. Well, your real estate is still, you know what I mean? It's a separate entity from that. And the good thing about real estate is you don't know what it's worth technically. Yes. Exactly. And that keeps people, I think, from like doing crazy things. It's not as liquid, which some people, stock traders will say, oh no, it's not liquid, I don't want to deal with it. But it is kind of, because you can always refinance it or sell it, you know, within a month or so in most situations, if you have a good property. But that's also a plus too, because now you're not, You know what I mean? I can't log in and like log into an account and check what my property's worth. I can run some rough numbers when I get a report or something like this, but I'll never know exactly.
And there's some unease to that where you don't really know what it is, and it's all subject to what's going on around you, and it's ultimately worth what somebody's going to pay for it. And you can do all the analytics you want, but at the end of the day, that's what you're resting on.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you're buying better properties, those are going to be the ones that are going to be more liquid through all parts of the market cycle. And bad properties and good markets, they might be sold. You know what I mean? So if you have, a C or D class property, they might have people that want to buy it during a good market. Not so much in a bad market. You know what I mean? When we're going through a pullback. No, if you have a good property though, you have a solid property and going through bad times, you're still going to have people, maybe that's the same price, but you're still going to have people interested in buying it because they see that it's a good asset.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I want to tab that page and we're going to get back to it, because I had one other question, because we get guests on here. Some are like you, where I grew up in a real estate family and my grandpa and his grandpa and my grandmother. And then there are others that are like, I was a school teacher and I wanted to make passive income, so I bought a rental and now I've got 10. So it's everyone in between. Can you take us back to like you being a kid, seeing you said it was just your father, or was it both of your parents?
And it was just my father. My mom was a school teacher, elementary school teacher, her whole
career. Okay. So as you're growing up, you're seeing your dad invest in real estate. Would you like go to work with him or sit with him and talk about real estate? Is that where like the seed was planted? Did you know this is where you were going to end up, or?
Yeah. So early on, my dad owned, let's just say, less ideal properties. They were like C and D class. Well, that's C. There were D class properties. I'm being nice. C minus class properties, let's just say. They were terrible.
We'll give them a passing grade.
Yeah. So they were just terrible properties. And my dad, back in the 80s, it was a completely different time than it is now. Back then, I would just be, we go back in like the late 80s, and I just remember not even that old at all. And you'd go to like Friendly's or some cafe, and people would sign properties back and forth to each other. There's no due on sale clauses. It was the Wild West, the 80s. There was less, everybody was making so much money in the 80s. And so it was a completely different thing. The tax system was all different than it is now. There's a lot more depreciation. All types of people were investing in real estate. With all that being said, so he really got properties that he wasn't really putting a lot of money down on. And that's what kind of built his portfolio. Because you go through and you're like, oh, wow, hundreds of units, all stuff, or 80 units, I don't know what it was, 90 units. Him and a partner had it at one point. It was something that they just were less ideal properties. But a lot of them, you get in with zero money. And because you had people that realized what the hell they just bought, and they tried to manage it. And C minus D class properties are extremely, D class properties are extremely management intensive. Never do it. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I never did it per se like that. My father did it, but they were very, these were like cash cows because they were so inexpensive when they were bought. So they did make a lot of money for what you paid. But the thing though is that during the week, I'd be like one night a week, and then usually like on a Saturday morning or something like this, you'd go to the property. So they're only 20 minutes from where we were, but a completely different lifestyle from where I was brought up. And you went to the properties, and it was my dad dealing with, because he self-managed them. He had like a small team of superintendents. And so it was him meeting with contractors, him meeting with supers, collecting rent that his super, like getting the cash the superintendents had collected, or many times it was us going and picking up the last couple of units in each property that hadn't paid rent and going door to door, knocking doors, going in. My dad had the spiral bound carbon copy book, going in there, sitting at people's kitchen tables, writing receipts. And so you really learn.
It's wild.
I've never done that with any of my tenants when I collect, even when I collected for 6 years cash door to door, like it was never, I never went to anybody's house to do it. You know what I mean? It was on the doorway. My dad had a lot more personal, personality about him of learning how to deal with tenants was very important that I learned from him. Because when you're dealing in C and D class properties, the lease is one thing, but it doesn't really hold any water per se. You know what I mean? Not really many people follow the lease in those type of properties. So you're always working out deals. You're just doing deals, and people that are by the book, you'll never make money in C and D properties. You just never will. So it's something that every time you go collect rent, you're negotiating to get certain money here. Everybody's got a story, and you have to be there's a lot of moving parts. It's not just like getting a, you know, getting a money order in the mail or a check in the mail for $1,500 and be like, okay, great. Like I got my rent for the week. It's never like that easy. That's why you buy like B and A class properties. But
yeah,
but it was like, you know, it was a huge learning experience about dealing with people, about, I never really wanted to get into real estate at that time because I was like, this is like terrible. You know what I mean? Like these properties are awful. The people you deal with are less than ideal. I mean, it was just like, it wasn't what I wanted to do. And then I think, like high school came around and, you know, you really learned about the whole residual income thing. You know what I mean? Where we could go on vacation for a month at a time. We go, you know, road trips, stuff like this. We had a summer house we go to and my dad was always there. And so that stuff you just don't get with your friends that were, even if they had more prestigious careers as doctors or attorneys and, you know, whatever it is in normal upper class white, you know, wealthy areas, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, that's what it is. But it was just like the residual income is just something that was it's a huge thing. And you don't notice it until you start actually making a little money, even if it's like a side job. And you're like, oh, man, this is pretty terrible. You know what I mean? Like cleaning tables and doing landscaping and stuff like that. And then you kind of like think about it. You're like, oh, you know, like the residual income. No wonder this is so powerful. And like this all makes sense now. But the main difference was that when I started buying properties, my dad was like, you got to buy in better areas. And he started doing it at the end of his career. He started buying smaller properties, like 3-unit properties in better areas. And that was like, that was a much more sustainable business strategy because you just got better tenants. You got better area. It's the whole thing. You know what I mean? And I did the same thing when I purchased. And one property I bought was questionable, but all the other ones were all in that C plus area type thing. And you know, you get people, and I had some tenants for 10 plus years in those properties.
Yeah. They're, I do like the, those C class, B and C class properties. I'm glad you brought up the A to D class properties. Cause like you were saying, in that D class property, it's a lot more management intensive. And I tend to think that both sides of the spectrum is intense. They're different side of intense, but one is more like the concierge. You got to do like all the nice amenities, which is labor intensive. The other one is labor intensive just because it's usually an older home. So there's maintenance. You're doing low-income housing, so that's, they've got financial stresses and labors there. Like you were talking about, going Saturday to go pick up money, which, by the way, I am just so glad I've never had to do that because to me, that is a thick skin that you have to go in face-to-face with somebody that you understand is not financially well off, and they're trying to get by or have a story of what's going on in their situation. So, man, and to experience that at a young age for you has to be eye-opening.
Yeah. My dad had all these phrases when people would say, like, he was just very good at handling people and managing, like, just.
Yeah, you have to be.
And it would just be like, I remember we were in one apartment and I was standing behind him. He was at this kitchen table and they had like a plastic cover over the kitchen table type thing, kind of thing. And my dad's like writing on it. It's like creaking and stuff. And the guy goes, and my dad was saying something. He's like, he's like, I got to pay that guy downstairs for work. And the person gave him money. He goes, well, now you got money. He goes, you know how it goes, in one hand, out the other. And my dad had all these little sayings. And they're like, oh, I know what you mean. You know what I mean? Like to put them on the same level as him. Yeah. And it was, I don't know, it was just very, you know, it was, it's much different. When I rented apartments, I never had anybody so personable to me like that. You know what I mean? Because it's just a, you know, it's face to face with cash. I mean, it's just like someone just cashed your paycheck and it's giving it to you. So,
yeah. And there was really no other easier way. They didn't have online softwares in the 80s to process. Because since I've been in real estate, I've never picked up a check or cash. Yeah, Within one of my buildings, it's just a mandatory you pay online because it's easier for everybody.
Yeah, it's definitely the way to go. When I hired my first third-party property manager, and my dad never had a third-party property manager, and I remember this is like 2012, I remember telling him, like, you know, how I collect these, like, you should never be collecting cash. They get money orders because he's like, I'm not collecting cash. You know what I mean? Obviously, mm-hmm. because there can be fraud in there. Like, you know, he was a very professional by the book property manager. And so it's very important that you don't do what I was doing, but this is just how it worked. You know what I mean? And it was just like, it's something that I learned as I go. And I use my dad as a mentor to one hour, but it's also, I'd rather accept cash than check. So it's just like in certain situations, and not many people paid me in money order. So it's really just like, you get a check. That thing is like, I'm bringing to the bank, the ink's still wet on that. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just how it is because it's the demographic you're working with. it's like, you know, people that are using a debit card until it stops working kind of thing. And they just paid rent and they must forget that they just paid me $900 and wrote me a check and now they're going out on Friday or whatever it is. So I need to get in there and make sure that clears before that happens. Yeah. And it's just what it happened. It's just, it's a demographic. I don't want to scare people on this. This is why the whole thing is if you buy properties, buy better properties. You're going to get enticed. And I think it's a normal progression with real estate investors where they start with less than ideal properties. And then they move up to better properties. And that happened with my dad very slowly. But he like sold out of all his stuff in like the late 90s, early 2000s. And stuff he buys, he's bought recently or stuff he buys himself now. It's just it's more C plus B minus type stuff. And or he invests with us with what we're doing. So which is definitely like B class stuff. So that's the whole thing about that. But just, you know, a lot of new investors, they send me over stuff and it's just something like, look at the returns on this. It's so great. I'm like, this is trouble. This is going to be a management issue. You're never going to be able to sell it. And then when you go to sell it, I mean, even, you know, you go to sell it, you're going to be having like two people that want to buy it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to, you know, you can't win at that. So buy better properties. It's going to hurt you a little bit to make that purchase. Cause you're like, I'm overpaying for it, blah, 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 or whatever you think in your mind. And then after you do a little work to it, after you put good tenants into it or keep the good tenants that are there, then at that point, when you go to sell it, it's going to be worth a lot more because you're going to get a lot more appreciation. With bad properties, you don't get appreciation. You get cash flow and that's fantastic,
yep.
But you don't get appreciation and it's a management hassle and you can't hire a third party. My dad would never have been able to hire a third party manager for those. No one would take it. No one's going.
Oh, you don't think they would ever?
No, it's like you might find some third party managers that do it, but you need to really, whenever I've sold properties that were like less, you know, C minus properties and stuff, it only goes to an individual person that's probably self-managing them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And anytime I've seen it, yeah.
You probably pick your poison on that one. Cause in terms of, all right, we classified our building A through D, the ones that are going to take the management on that D property are probably going to be the D management companies. So instead of managing your tenants, you're going to manage the management company. So I guess pick your poison.
Yeah. And the other thing too, is that like the stuff that we were doing, you're not having a management company that's going to go there, collect cash, number one. And they're definitely not going to be over there. You know, people higher up in the company being over there on a Saturday, picking up, you know, and then when you're in these properties, if someone says, hey, I know I owe you 400 and they have 100, you're going over there and getting $100. You know what I mean? Yeah. And management company won't do that. They're going to just hope you come to the office and drop off the $100, which doesn't happen. So it's just one of those things is that you have to be, it's a lot more management intensive. And it's just the demographic of what you're working with. When you start getting into like C plus and above, these are people that at some point want to buy a house. They have car loans. These are what like regular car loans, not like buy here, pay here type places. So they're credit tenants is what we call them. And these are people that actually like have credit. They have 3x income in most cases, you know what I mean, of what rent is. These are people that can pay their bills. And if they lose 5 hours a week from their job, they're still going to be able to pay you rent. Whereas, you know, I was just reading a stat a few months back that was just like average C-class tenant has like $400 in savings. So if there's a disruption there and they have a $1,200 monthly payment to you, you are in, they're not paying you or they're working out some deal with you. Your collections will drop dramatically.
Yeah. I mean, that's the difference of a car issue.
Yeah. Yes.
Their car goes down. And I mean, that could be residual of a couple months of catch up.
Right. Yeah. So now,
a riskier part. And like you were saying earlier, there are still, I guess, windows or opportunities in those D-class areas. You just have to understand as an investor what you're getting yourself into. And personally, I would have no problem with D-class properties if my lifestyle could do that. Me being the single dad at home with the son, I guess I could technically on Saturdays go and take him for the day and go do all the things we need to catch up on. But it would be in an area that's probably a little bit of a distance away.
Yeah.
So just, it doesn't make sense. And there's enough B and C class around me that's kind of where we stick. But I do like that you mentioned that there is opportunities in those D class. You just have to be prepared that you're going to have a different type of problem, I guess, in that area. You got problems in every class. It's just pick that one. And you had mentioned before, and Dan, can you recall who the guest was that said, a lease is great, but a lease is only as good as you want to pay to enforce it. So like you were saying, like you have your leases in place, but you're making deals, and your dad was making deals at the door with these tenants. And in all actuality, the lease is only as good as you want to pay to enforce it, which was a huge like light bulb moment in my head.
Yeah.
I don't remember who it was that said that, but yeah, I do remember hearing it.
Yeah, it just kind of stuck with me. And that kind of gave me like kind of insight of your dad at the doorstep, like making the deals to make sure, like, just don't make us go to court to settle this thing. Let's figure this out and we can make it all work.
Yeah, I remember going to court with my dad too a number of times. It's just like you did
it. Oh,
that
was my next question.
Went to court. My dad was a back of the napkin kind of investor. Like, my dad doesn't know what IRR meant up until like a few years ago. So it's like, you know, all these fancy private equity terms. It was really just like cash on cash was all that mattered. Obviously, that's why he's buying D-class properties. But it was just something that was, you went to court and we went to police stations looking through mug books. I mean, it was a lot of stuff that I got involved with that most people probably haven't. And it was, you know, when you're going through court and stuff like that, and you're working out deals with people, and it's all, you know, it's just like the same thing. You just like people can sign the lease, but it's really just like, I mean, if people really believe, they wouldn't, you know, in the lease being so solid when you signed it, people wouldn't ask for copies of pay stubs. You know what I mean? You know, they would believe the person, but obviously they want to back it up. And, you know, the harder it is to evict in that municipality, the more information that they're going to do their underwriting. You know, it's a much different underwriting experience getting an apartment in Tampa than it is in Manhattan. You know what I mean? For the reason that we can evict someone rather quickly compared to someone in Manhattan. So they're going to do a lot different underwriting on them up there versus us down here, for example. So these are just interesting things you have to know about when you're going to invest. You have to know about the area that you're investing in, first of all, the state, and then down to the local level, because you can have, you know, you might say Texas landlord friendly, you know, Austin has its own rules. You know what I mean? So these different things you have to know and how they differ. California is one thing. Los Angeles is a whole different thing. So it's like when you're going in these different pockets, understand exactly, because this is like how important it is to choose a good tenant. And it's terrible when you're going to these areas because they think, oh, we have a lot of tenant, all these protections for them. But as a landlord on the other side, I'm really making sure that I'm getting the cream of the crop that goes in there. If I'm renting in Florida, yeah, I mean, like, you know, I can go down to a lower credit score. I can do this. I can do that. Because if you pay your rent, you're perfectly fine. If you tell me what you're telling me and it's true, then you're fine. But if you're not, then I can get you out rather quickly. If it took me a year, then I'm not going down to anybody in this sub sixes, you know, credit score, and I want to make sure that you have a, you know, 740 or whatever it is that whatever you're renting, you know what I mean? And that hurts people that might be going through a little tougher time that they can still pay you, but it doesn't look as stellar on paperwork. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it's amazing the knowledge you got as a kid. And obviously it's helping you in your career now and where you've gotten so far. So you went off on your own after, you said it was college, right?
Right after I graduated college. Yeah, I started investing my own property first time.
Did you started in Connecticut. What made the push to Florida? Was it like the municipality things that you were just talking about? Was it the amazing weather? Like what was the push after you had a portfolio? Because for some investors, that would be super hard to leave.
So my parents had like made it pretty clear a couple of years before while I was in college that they were going to be down in Florida. So I knew it's kind of like it's going to be a natural progression. I would make it down there at some point. And so I had bought properties up there. I was still running, you know, business up there. I was finishing out college. And then when I moved down, it really forced me to get third party management that I probably wouldn't have done if I stayed up there, which was great because I now had a lot more time to buy properties and spend time on other high, you know, high income type hourly things compared to managing, you know, properties per se. So that was a great push to do that. And it was in 2012, the properties had appreciated, but they were running fine. We had done, you know, before I did it, I spent a lot of time doing a lot of work at the properties, you know, changing over a lot of mechanicals, doing a lot of stuff that would last for 10 plus years, you know, doing roofs, all this kind of stuff. So when I left, a lot of the major CapEx was already done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I did windows at one of the properties. And then so it was pretty straightforward. And then I had my property manager let me know in 2021 that they're retiring. And I just made the decision to sell at that point. So it was like, and then we sold at the beginning of 2022, not knowing that was going to be the higher part of the market, but it's just kind of how it works out. So
worked out well.
Yeah, no, it worked out great. It worked out great. It's just, you know, those were properties. It was a portfolio of like C-class properties. And since they weren't, you know, the most sought after properties, there weren't that many buyers for the properties. So I found a landlord there that had like 60 units and wanted more units there from New York. And he actually bought the whole portfolio from us. But it was just one of those things that was, you know, it's just if you had more, you know, if you had properties that were in more demand, you could get, you know, you'd have more buyers, you'd have, you know what I mean? It's just difficult when you're dealing with properties that are older, less ideal, you have less buyers for them. So you make money on it, but it's not like if I had bought those properties in 08 or 09 in Florida, you know what I mean?
Okay. So. Yeah. And then obviously removing the portfolio, or getting rid of the portfolio in Connecticut, you kind of have a fresh start in Florida and you're in this new area. I'm sure your dad had given you some insight of Florida, but for you personally, you are like dropped into a brand new market that you get to go and analyze and figure out what pockets you want to invest in. So when you start your business down in Florida, or the restart of your business in Florida, how did you go through like mentally the areas you wanted to pick? What were some of the key things you were like, these are my, I don't know, key indicators of the good market that I want to get into? Were there anything that stuck out when you hit the restart button?
Just like I was looking at where I was living in Palm, Southeast Florida, so Palm Beach area at that time where I'm back living now. And it was something that when I was looking at properties, it was a, there's very over, very expensive, you know what I mean? Compared to what I was used to per unit. I saw higher crime rates. It was just a little different than buying parts of where I was used to in Connecticut. So when I initially, when we bought our first larger property in Florida, it was over in Tampa. I bought it with some other guys, and we did a syndication, and this was several years back. And we ended up selling that about 2 years ago, or no, a year and a half ago, and 2022, the beginning of it. And but it was just something that was a very similar property to what I was used to. That was a C plus area, plus your building area. It was a much newer property than what I was used to. All my properties in Connecticut were like 100 plus years old, so it was really? Yeah, this down here was like built in the 60s. I was like, oh, this is things like brand new, you know what I mean? But it was, just the growing area, the quality of the property was like the same, I would say. But the area was just was growing so much that when we, you know, we rode, you know, like 2019, all that up to 2022, that appreciation, which is still going now. And the person that owns it now, they just bought another property from us over in Tampa as well. And I mean, they're going to ride that appreciation as well. You know what I mean? It's not going anywhere. And they're not building any of these other properties that were built in the 60s or 80s. You know what I mean? So they, you know, they have quite the niche in the market because, you know, they're building new stuff, but that new stuff is going to be $2,000 a unit a month. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this stuff is was $1,100, $1,200. So, you know, it's just... That's what I really focused on getting into. Over the last, we just sold our last C-class property. So really since 2020, end of 2020, really just been focusing on, I would say B- and above properties. And I would buy C-class again, but not in a syndication with passive investors. There's just a lot of parts of it that you can't control. You know what I mean? $400 in the bank account type stuff, whenever there's a hiccup. And now you're, you know, you don't want to bring back properties to your investors and say that, hey, we had to pause distributions or we had to do this or do that because of this issue. When we're in B class properties, I just find that it runs a lot smoother. Yes, upfront, you're paying for better properties and you have to get, you know, comfortable with doing that. But the appreciation is something, you know, rent growth and the appreciation is a lot better in the higher you go. I don't really do A-class properties as an active investor. I passively invest in some of those. And that's a different animal as well, just like D is on the other side, like you were saying initially. But we've really found over the last few years that B-class is really where what's in our wheelhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a couple reasons why, like, because I'm in the same boat. I like to invest in the C and B class. B, obviously, for the reasons we've been talking about. But when I was early on in my investing career, obviously, I've been told about the D class problems. And I'm sure people that aren't investors could assume what your problems are in the D class. But the A class, I assumed like, oh, it's an A. It's the best one to invest in. And then you start finding out about all the other things that... kind of our negatives about the property or the tenants or the management side of it. And the one thing that kind of hit me was in a down market, like the market swings. Because in that time I was studying to be an agent. So you're going into the analytics of the market. And the broker that I was working for, I believe, shared with me that he didn't invest in A because in the down market, everybody moves down a class. So if you're in an A, you go to B. If you're in a B, you go to C. So A's are just vacant. So in that regard, I was like, well, that's a risk that I don't want to sit on, especially if I'm early. If I'm paying the high money and something happens with the market that everybody moves down a class and I've got an A building that I just put millions of dollars into and now it's vacant, like that is a huge, huge vulnerability for the company. And that's kind of why I pulled away from A.
The other thing too is a new, if you're buying B-class properties for $110,000 a door and new A-class is coming on for $180,000, that's what's costing the build. And so if you buy A, you know, you now have to worry about any new inventory that's coming on the market is all A. Nothing's coming in that's going to be a B. So if you own B, you don't have to worry too much about the A, unless they start like dramatically dropping prices or something like this, which, you know, they might do, but it's still going to be higher than what you're charging. So B is something interesting, like you were saying, that I think renters make it through B class at some point in their life. And B class, you have a lot of people. A, I have a lot of people that are now competing with mortgages too. So you have a lot of prime buyers that can literally buy a house, you know, they can move in and then they can also just buy a house without renewing. B are going to be people that are a little bit strapped more, but they're growing. They are making money in their profession. C are people that probably for the most part won't be buying a house too much. So you're going to have a lot of long-term tenants there, which is great, but you're getting much better tenants in the B that for what you're paying for the unit with not as much competition as with A. I've also found A having higher vacancy too, being a little harder to rent those properties. C-class properties, you can rent a whole building in a weekend. But like A, it's much more difficult to find a really good tenant that's going to have all the income, that's going to check all the boxes to rent your $2,300 a month apartment and show you that they're making $7,000 a month. So
yeah. And that wants to stick around for a long time, like you'd mentioned.
Yeah. Because if you start having the turnover, the main thing in long-term rentals is you want to get the people there for 23, 24 plus months, right? You want them for 2 years. If they can renew for at least 1 year, possibly 2 years, that's where you're dramatically cutting down on your make ready, you know, your vacancy costs, all that stuff. If you have people that are consistently moving after a year, you just are adding so much. If the place is vacant for a year or a month, you right now that's 8% off. Plus you got to make ready. Plus you got to do all the hassle. Plus you got to re-rent it. And if you can do all that in a month, that's great. But then you have to pay for it. I mean, at the end of the day, you're probably losing 2 months between of rent and with costs. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because when you re-rent it again, you're going to have to pay your management company to do that. And then you're going to probably have 1 month of rent was just cleaning and repairing some stuff. So it's a difficult proposition when people aren't staying there for over at least over a year.
In that situation, would you ever discount the next year? They basically calculate your costs. Like you just said, I'm going to lose 2 months because I got to move you out, get it ready for the next tenant, get the property management to get it set up. But what if you say, hey, if you stay out, knock off $100 a month for the next year?
I think where we are, I've never lowered rent like that. Mm-hmm. I have just not increased rent, and I've done that a lot. And then, you know, that's not a healthy thing to do either. Even if we're going through a lower inflationary period, you still want to raise that rent like 2 or 3%. Okay. You know what I mean? The tenants are thinking they're going to get a rent increase and just something that lets them know that this is a consistent thing, because then I'd rather have that 2 or 3, because you read all the time with people that are they're just newer landlords. They don't know. And they're like, oh, I haven't up, you know, everything was going great. So I didn't raise rent for 40 years and now it's 15%. So I'm just going to raise them 15%. Like, they're not staying. Like, you're a good tenant.
Yeah.
You know, if you had just like 3% a year, which really isn't that much. I mean, $1,000, you know, it's $1,030. And people understand everything else goes up around them. They go to the store. They drive by the gas station twice a day. I mean, they understand exactly where we're going with everything. So it's just like, I think it's dangerous, kind of. It can put you in a hard position when you're not raising that rent. But there's many times I haven't raised it before, you know, with good tenants. And then when someone moves out, that's where you can really, you you do the unit to where the appetite is for that market. You know what I mean? So if it's like, listen, I'm going to put, you know, $2,000 into this unit for doing over this and that, and I know I'm going to get like an extra $125 a month or something like this.
Yeah, makes that worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you do it there. But at that point, because what we do is when we're going through times now where we really don't know what's exactly happening right around the corner, you know, you might have four vacancies come up and you might do that with one or two. And then the other, you know, two or three, you might just do some painting and cleaning and rent it just a little higher and see where it is. And if you see, oh, everybody's calling for just these like lightly cleaned and, you know, recleaned and lightly repaired type stuff, like new hinges and stuff like that, that's where we should really be focusing on. You know what I mean? And instead of, you know, we should put like $1,000 into new turns that come like this, and you know what I mean? And we'll increase rent $60 versus going over here and spending $4,000 to try to get, you know, $175. So it's like, you know, less outlay, and you kind of see exactly what the appetite is for the market, because you don't want to overdo it in the market. And also a lot of people, they'll just pay that 2 or 3% just to stay in there, because especially the thing with COVID, people didn't know what was happening, and people don't know what's happening. They want to stay where they are. You know, yep. They want to stay with someone that's comfortable, somebody that obviously they have a professional relationship that's been going well for them, or okay, better than they think they're going to get elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting kind of that when you come up to those, it's really per property and like your relationship with them and what your goal is for the property too.
Yeah.
And I like that the whole topic got brought up of like lease renewals and what you do, because I've even brought up at the end of your term, your first year, say, hey, you can re-up for the next year and you can sign another year and I won't raise the rent. And that's like their benefit of, I'm not going to raise it. Or you do have the option to go month to month, but it's going to come with $25 more a month.
Yeah.
So I build in that buffer because I don't know when they're going to leave. And I also do, like, if you go month to month, there's some months where you cannot vacate. If you're going to go month to month, we can't vacate in December or in November, because it's just going to be brutal. Yeah. You're not going to want to move, and like you can't really find a tenant, and usually they're fine with that one. So
that's funny. That's a nationwide thing too. Even in Florida, people don't move, and like I'm like, December's like the best month to move, man. Yeah, but it's just like the renting season. It's just like it's like a national thing, the rental season. I never thought of that, because up north you're like, yeah, of course no one's going to move, and like Connecticut, it's like 5 degrees or something in February. But down here, I'm like, really? Like this is how it works. It just happened again this year. I mean, it's a normal thing. It's just crazy everywhere. So it's just,
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah,
just because of Texas.
That's crazy. But yeah, it is funny that it is human nature. You live in your comfort, it's your mm-hmm. safe zone. You want to stay usually within those 2 to 3% bumps. It's enough for them to say, like, all right, I justify the safety. I don't have to get a U-Haul and move all the stuff mm-hmm. and like get family and friends to come help me move for the fourth time in 4 years. So they usually like to stay, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just, you're being good. You're being a good landlord, and it's a win-win, and every deal should be a win-win, because that's where you're going to keep people long-term.
Yeah. And it's a delicate industry. You are dealing with property, but you are dealing with human beings, and you, mm-hmm. you have to respect that, and you have to be able to work with them. Because if you don't, if your dad did not work with all of his tenants, he would not have been able to do what he did. It's impossible.
You won't make any money. You won't make any money. You know, you have to. And so that's one motivation for it. But the other thing too is that obviously there are people, and you're trying to, like, you know, you're trying to keep everybody happy and make win-win situations. Yep. And there's sometimes where people aren't going to be happy with you. And there's sometimes where people are going to be, you know, where you're not going to be happy with what you did. It's I don't know. I had an attorney tell my dad years back that he goes, a judge would know it's a good court case if both parties walk out unhappy. So it's kind of like, I always remember that when anything, because you're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. That's when you know, like, you rule the right way. When
you split it right down the middle.
Everyone's pissed off.
I'm going to keep that one in the memory bank. I like that one. All right. And then, so I'm assuming you started with smaller buildings, you worked your way up, and then you mentioned mixed use. So now you're getting into, I'd call it commercial, but you owned apartment complexes, so that kind of is commercial as well. Was the jump from residential to commercial a big jump for you and the company, or do you see a lot of similarities? What was the transition? Because for a lot of investors that I've talked to, that especially when they're starting out, commercial is the Wild West of like the 80s, like you were mentioning earlier in the show.
Yeah. So just to paint a little background. So when I bought property the first time, it was at the end of 06. Then I bought it again. It was at the end of 08. And this is like 2 months after Lehman, 2 months before Bernie Madoff. So like every time you turn on the TV, someone was defrauding something. Some bank was going out of business. Some lender was like not doing loans anymore. You know what I mean? Or going out of business or both. And it was crazy. 2009 was just the same. And I, you know, the property I had bought. So just to paint a little quick background is that this was I was renting an office at the time. So I wanted a property with an office in it. And this was literally all my properties in Connecticut were literally within like 0.4 of a mile of each other. Very easy to maintain. I like bought them all strategically around each other. So this one was like that too. And it had a 400 square foot office with a half bath and then four apartments over it. And then the property, it was on the market sitting there for literally like 4 or 5 months, because back then there was no financing for these type of properties. If you had large apartments, just in the commercial, it's considered commercial because it had commercial property in it. But residential 1 to 4 units were selling because you had FHA and they could get an FHA mortgage. And that'd be like a first time home buyer. They could come in, they could put 3%. These houses were still moving. People are still flipping houses during all of this craziness. Everything was going that way. But the thing though is that commercial financing, especially, you know, your local banks, your $1 million or below loan amounts, we're not moving. No one was lending on this at all. It had to be everything purchased in cash. And there weren't even that many like lenders around hard money. There weren't really bridge lenders around, if any. It wasn't really an industry yet. It was really just like finding hard money lenders. And if they lent you 50% loan to value, you'd be lucky. You know what I mean?
Really?
And it was something that when this property had sold and the bank sold 2 years earlier and the bank had put it on the market for like, I don't know, 40% of what it had sold for, right? And it sat there. So I came in, I put it like a bid 30% under that, and they countered and they're like, listen, we have one more offer, you know, best and final, all this kind of stuff. And so I went up like, you know, 1% or something, and they took it. And so I bought this property literally like 28 cents on the dollar of what it sold for, you know, years before, which back then we were like, doesn't even matter, because I was just like, it was a crazy amount of number. You know what I mean? It didn't even make sense. So you couldn't really use that as you're like comparing anything. I did some work to it. And I rented it out. And it was like within 90 days. And it was during winter because I bought it in December 2009. So it was a lot of outside work, a lot of exterior stuff. And I had these guys there that are doing great work on the interiors and on the exterior. And it was great. We did the units over. Some of them needed some work. Some of them didn't. They just needed.
And like, were these units all vacant up top?
Yeah, the whole thing, everything was vacant. The whole property was vacant. It was just winterized, locked, padlocked, you know, type stuff. So, you know, I put in like 15 new doors. I put in, you know, all this new stuff. I put new windows in, all types, everything, kind of a lot of stuff into this property. Did the office first because that's where we were moving into, and then everything else afterwards. And it was easier for me to manage because I was there, you know what I mean? Which makes it a lot easier to manage everybody coming and going, pay people as they go, make sure people are doing what they say. And so that was one part of it. And the thing though is that, just to finish this out about where we were, was that after finishing this property, a bank that I had a relationship with, that my dad had a relationship with, lending and regular banking, everything like this, they came to the property after it was all done. And they literally would have given me less than 20%, not like any profit in there. They weren't doing like loan to value or anything like this. They're like, we understand like what you paid for it and what you put into it. And they literally gave me like, they're like, we can do like a 15% loan to value. That's what they're going to do on it.
Really?
It was insane. It was,
they just like, didn't see the actual value of the building? Man,
it was like, it had nothing to do with it. And I had done really well, like in, you know, I had another business at the time because I paid for all the stuff in cash at this time during 2009. And I was like showing them tax returns and all stuff. Like, no, we understand all of this. We understand everything here, but like, you've got to change. You need to do, change the entity on this property from this LLC to this. You need to do this, you need to do that, and then we'll give you like 15% loan to your cost, not loan to value, loan to cost. Wow. Because I was renting it out at that point for like $2,500, or like, you know, gross was like maybe $3,000 a month, you know what I mean? And like, they're like, oh, we'll give you like, you know, just like 15% of what you say you put into it, you know what I mean? Because it's obviously you can't lose. Wow. And it was just like, so you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to refinance. I'm not refinancing. Yeah. What the hell am I going to do with $15,000 or whatever it was, $20,000 or, you know, 30, whatever it was. And it was like, okay, well, then that's it. You know what I mean? So you just like held it for cash flow. And then I remember going to like hard money lenders and they're like, we, you know, they're like, I see what you bought it for. I see what the appraisal is. You bought it for this. I'll give you like half of what you bought it for. You're like, well, I did all this work to it and all this stuff. Like, no, I'll give you, we'll loan you half of what you like bought it for. It's like not counting. It was just like, it was completely different. That's why the market was that's why the pullback, because the financing just dropped out. So when the financing drops out of real estate, that's it. It's like, there's nothing left. And the only thing that all of those flippers and other people that got starts in FHA, or if you're doing large apartment complexes, you could go back to like Fannie and Freddie and stuff like that. And they were still servicing loans. They were still putting out loans, but it was something that any of the regional banks, they were closed up for business. And that is the lifeblood of smaller investors. You know what I mean? Because even if you went and wanted to buy a second three-family house, you now have to go through a lender and it's now an investment loan, right? You can't just go through, can't do another FHA loan for that. So now it's like, how the heck do I do this? So you're using hard money. It's just like, I would remember talking to a lender, people that I bought properties from that were like big investors in the town as well. And they're like, oh, call this hard money lender, blah, blah, blah. And then when he's telling me what rates he's getting and terms he's getting, and I call him, I'm not getting anywhere near this, because it's just all about relationships that you build over the years.
Yeah.
So there's people still lending, but you had to have the relationships. You had to, it was difficult. It was difficult. And people look back on that time, like, oh, wow, what a deal you got and all this stuff, man. Like, you have no idea. This is not like, even today, you can go and be, there's still bridge lenders out there. If you want to pay 9%, I mean, you can get money pretty quickly and you can get it with pretty high loan to values. Not like a year and a half ago, but back then, man, when there's no money, you know what I mean, available for rent for what you're doing, that's when the prices drop. Because if that had been a 4-unit property, the pricing would have been a lot different.
Right.
But also, I would have been able to refinance that. You know what I mean? Or sell it. I bought this property knowing I wasn't going to be able to sell this for many years. And that's not something that I think most people even think about today when they're buying property. Even if they buy property, even a D-class property, I do some work to it. I do something. I collect rent for 2 years. I probably can sell it for at least, you know, all I have into this. You know what I mean? And just keep the cash flow over those two years as profit. Back then, you're just like, you wouldn't be able to sell it. You know, I could put that thing up if the bank couldn't sell that thing. You know what I mean? And they're literally giving the thing away. You know what I mean? Like, what am I going to do? And like, who's going to finance the buyer? You know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's like, unless someone's coming with full cash, but then you're not going to make any money because they're going to want, you know, every deal like you did. So it's difficult.
I'm sure with that building, because it was a little bit, a little bit out of the box outside of what they usually lend. Because in that time when lending gets kind of stringent, like they pull back a lot, they want to go like the FHA route where there's like the house has to be clean, neat. Yeah. It's got to fit into this little box. Mm-hmm. There can't be chipping paint. Like everything needs to be working order. Otherwise, they don't lend on it because it's risk aversion. They just don't want to lend out to something that's going to be more risky. And with that being a multi-use, I'm sure they looked at that as a huge risk, even though you're telling them like your numbers on it, which is the annoying thing about lending, because you always have to fit into the little box, even though a normal person, even the underwriter that you're talking to, can see it. But when they type it into their computer, you only get what the bank wants to lend to you.
Yeah, that's completely true. And then that was when I started seeing, because this property was like 90% plus square footage of residential. So I started seeing stuff online when I was looking for lenders, or like years later when I was trying to refinance it, and they still had these like things like, we're only lending if 85% of it is residential, you know, square footage wise, and all these type of things. You're like, and now you know, it's difficult to rent commercial properties. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, commercial units. And this is a small, unique property. It's not like renting out a 4,000 square foot restaurant. You know what I mean? Like, you can just find somebody that wants to leave their paperwork there and charge them a few hundred dollars a month, which is what I had up until selling it as a tenant. And, it's just a very, you know, these banks want stuff that fits in the box. Like you said, no boarded up windows in the neighborhood. They don't want to see one tarp anywhere, no matter even if there's construction going on there. Mm-hmm. Like they want to make sure that this limits all the risk. I mean, it makes sense. You know what I mean? You're not going to want to really rent. Are you going to pay a higher premium if you're driving down the street and you see a boarded up window or someone have a tarp on their place, and then you come back a week later and it's still there as you drive by? You know,
yeah.
I mean, you're just not. You're not, and that makes it difficult for.
But then you got to go fix up the neighborhood to get your loan. Hey, let me take care of that window for you.
I was watching last night. I was watching HGTV show where this couple's moving to the East Coast, but they didn't have the down payment. So I think one of the parents was paying for the property, but the four of them went to go house showing, like go look at all the houses of where they're moving. And she wanted, I think she's from Albuquerque, somewhere in New Mexico. She wanted like that style home, and they were moving to Connecticut. So you being from Connecticut, you're not going to really find that style. So she's trying to not find an HOA, not find something cookie cutter, but their bank, aka the parents, were like, resale. All I want is HOA. I want no tarps, no broken, no maintenance. Yeah. I want floors that you're not going to damage. And they were just button heads. And I'm like, man, this would be literally, if I had my mortgage broker come with me and like talk in my ear about all the things he's not going to lend on. And I'm like, oh my God, this is annoying. I couldn't watch the episode anymore. But that's what I felt like. The mortgage lender just like, nope, 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 needs to be better.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
It was only like the 1 to 4 units. I mean, that was the only thing. I mean, even duplexes, we didn't flip during that whole time. It was only when I flipped houses during that time as well. It was only single families, 3-2s. We had this, like, my dad and my brother and I, we worked together and did some flips, and it was like 1,200 square feet to 14. You know, like, you had the specific thing that what was going to sell, people wanted to buy. Yeah. And you had no problem of like, you know, and you had really good comps. You're like, okay, that one sold for 140 over there. We can pay 80 for this. You know what I mean? And so like, you have all these things that you're working on when you're doing it. So, but that's what it is. And every market cycle, you know what I mean? That's why it's a consistent changing business plan.
Yep.
And you see stuff happen again to a different extent. Like what we had here, what was going on. And I wasn't really in 2005, 2006 I was, and it was pretty crazy for the beginning of it before I actually bought. But 2007 beginning was like that. And then at the end of 2007, it was just, you know, 2008 just really came out. And it really didn't get back until for another few years to getting back to like normal stuff with lending and actually being able to, because you couldn't refinance properties either. You know what I mean? And mortgage rates were dropping dramatically during this thing. I think like 6.5 I paid in 06. Like maybe 5.5, 08, and then 2010 I refinanced. It was like 4.25. So it was like a dramatic, you know, that's how they had to try to shake up the economy by cutting interest rates, which is probably what's going to happen today too. Nothing's going to come down until they break something. So
I know. And that's what we're waiting on. I'm going to call it doomsday on that one. We only got a couple minutes left. I know we talked about the past. What are you currently like? Where are you guys taking your business here towards the end of 2023 or setting up for 2024?
Yeah. So what we've been focusing on for the last several years is syndicating properties, multifamily properties. Now we're focusing on 100 unit plus properties in the Southeast of the United States.
Nice.
We partner with three different operators that we work with that are like boots on the ground in markets that we're not in. And so we are able to offer our passive investor, our clients, a diversity of where they're investing so they can get exposure to different markets. Going forward, we're still buying properties. I always want to be open to buying and also open to selling at any point if we get the right price. And I think for buying, it's just one of the things, it's very difficult to wait for the bottom. Obviously, everybody would like to buy at the bottom, but like when you buy at the bottom, you don't know you're buying at the bottom. And you never really buy exactly at the bottom. It's just really kind of how everything works. But, you know, if you're getting a discount versus you were before for years and you're able to cash flow out of the gates on your property, I mean, those are the most important things that you should be looking at when you're buying property. And that's what we're doing. And, you know, if we're getting deals on what it was a few years back, that's really what our goal is, and to see areas that are growing, you know, and we're buying in really growing markets. And we have a pretty strict criteria of going into states and into cities, MSAs that have shown growth over the last 20 years and will be, you know, continue to show that into the future.
Yeah. So these are all done in syndications, right? You said?
Yeah. Awesome. So everything is done syndications now as it is. I mean, I probably will buy some other properties myself in like joint ventures. At this point, I haven't done that anymore since selling out my whole portfolio last year, but of smaller stuff. But yeah, syndications are really what we found, and it's ability of buying better properties. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because then you can go with investors. Most investors can't afford like good quality B-class properties, or they buy like a single family house. So it's riskier in that situation. Not many investors can go out and buy like a nice, clean 10 plus unit B class property, you know what I mean? With their own funds. Or if they, and it's also kind of risky trying to find someone to partner with that you don't know. And you know what I mean? And like, let's each put up like a, you know, $200,000 to buy this property. It's kind of risky.
Yeah.
Whereas with our situation, we're able to offer for a much lower entry point to come in alongside us, because we invest usually about 20 to 25%. The joint general partners usually invest every deal of what's required. And so we invest alongside our, you know, our past investors, our partners in those deals, limited partners. And you can get some of the upside on working with us and the markets we're working on. And, you know, keeping our properties, we say 5 to 7 years. The last few years have been a lot faster than that, you know, usually right around 3 years. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to continue, but we'll really see what happens. But the main thing is that people are going to pay their rents and up, down, sideways markets, especially in B class.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so, I couldn't agree with you more on the B class. That's right where I'm sticking for now.
If somebody wanted to join a syndication, what are your your requirements, or what do you look for in an investor? What do you want from them?
Yeah, so our if they want to go to our website, harborsidepartners.com, so harborsidepartners.com, we go through a lot of information on learning more about syndication. We have I have a YouTube channel that I put on a couple episodes every week on syndication and investing into everything. And typically what happens with minimum investments is $50,000. And we take accredited and non-accredited investors as well. It just, in for non-accredited investors, we need to have some pre-existing relationship. The investor needs to have pre-existing relationship with myself or one of the other partners at our firm. And, you know, we can start that by, if you want to reach out to us, and we can start talking and go through everything that we do. And if it's something that works, possibly work together in the future.
Okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we will make a link to your YouTube channel for the show as well. Cause I mean, I know I will watch a couple episodes, cause you seem like a wealth of knowledge. And with it's probably a couple decades of real estate knowledge already under your belt.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
It probably doesn't feel that way, but like, if you think about you as a kid still starting the timing, I mean, you've got years under your belt. So we'll link to that. We'll link to your website as well.
Thank you.
Is that the best way to get in touch with you, is just through the website?
Yeah, go to harborsidepartners.com. Everything is there. If you want to reach out to me directly, you can set up a call there. You can also just put a form through on our website, sign for our investor club, sign for our mailing list, everything. We have a free book on passive investing in real estate and how it works. So there's a ton of information on our website. You can really understand what we're doing. And if you want to connect with me or somebody else on the team, just reach out and get on calls with people all day long.
I like that. That's awesome. That's super cool that you offer all that stuff.
Thank you.
That's great. Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. I'll be jumping on the website. I'll take a look at all that stuff and watch a couple of videos. But we should, I kind of want to see where their career takes off. We're going to have to keep in touch and see where things go, because you're in the position that I'm chasing. Like, I want to get into those bigger syndications and do all that stuff. So I'm going to watch you as you progress, and then I'll keep trying to chase you.
Sounds great, Marcus and Dan. Thank you so much, guys, for having me on.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.